second talk, our brother Jim would like us to read Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 through 37. We'll ask Brother Ryan King to read that for us, please. Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 through 37.
Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 to 37. Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law, till all be fulfilled. Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments, and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. Ye have heard that hath been said by them of old time, Thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, Thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. Agree with thine adversary quickly, whilst thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence, till thou hast paid the uttermost farthing. Ye have heard that hath been said by them of old time, Thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her, hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. And if thy right eye cause thee to stumble, pluck it out, and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. And if thy right hand cause thee to stumble, cut it off, and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that the whole body should be cast into hell. It hath been said, Whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. But I say unto you, that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causeth her to commit adultery. And whosoever shall marry her that is divorced, committeth adultery. Again, ye have heard that hath been said by them of old time, Thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. But I say unto you, Swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, neither by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, for thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let your communication be, yea, yea, nay, nay. For whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil.
Subject of Brother Jim's second class is the law of the heart. Brother Jim.
Thanks again, and well, brethren, sisters, and young people, we have come now to a section of the Discourse on the Mount, which is going to speak to us of the way in which the Christ character that has been revealed in the first 12 verses should be revealed in our lives. In Matthew chapter 5, from verses 13 to 16, we have the revealing of the Christ character and our relationship with the world because of it. Then he speaks of the new law in operation in verses 17 to 20, new and old law, and true righteousness must abound, he says. And the law of the heart,
Verses 21 to 24 will deal with hatred in the heart. Verses 25 to 26 of humility and error, judgment and mercy and peacemaking. And then he comes to the matter of the law of the heart, verses 27 to 32, adultery in the heart, and 33 to 37, truth in the heart. Now, we're not going to get up to verse 37 in this session, but we'll try and make it to verse 32 if we can. What we're going to find here, brethren and sisters and young people, is that this is about revealing Christ in our lives. And Brother Sargent says this, "This character is revealed in the very conditions of evil which exist in the interim before the kingdom of God is established. In those conditions, the character must retain its unfailing savour." Now that's a reference, of course, to salt, which belongs to the covenant with God. It's a very good summary of where we're up to in this discourse. And that's why he goes on to talk about the salt of the earth in verse 13. "Ye are the salt of the earth," he says. "But if the salt have lost his savour, wherewith shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing to be cast out and to be trodden under foot of men." Now, salt was fundamental in a warm climate. It was used in the preparation of food, we read in Job chapter 6, verse 6. In animal fodder, Isaiah chapter 30, verse 24. And salt had two main uses. It was used as a preservative. It arrested the decomposition, of course, of flesh. And it was used as a condiment. It gave zest and taste, savour to food. And salt in the Word of God is a symbol for faithfulness. We have references like Numbers chapter 18 and verse 19. And 2 Chronicles chapter 13, verse 5, which make reference to a covenant of salt. In other words, when covenants come into view, they must be kept, they must be preserved, they must not be allowed to corrupt. And so God refers to covenants in that way, a covenant of salt. And of course, we also have reference in Mark chapter 9, verses 49 and 50 to the matter of purity, zest and savour. It just so happens that salt occurs eight times in the New Testament. I wonder why eight times? Well, there were eight blessings, were there not, that lead to immortality. And salt is used eight times because this is about preserving something from corruption, bringing people to immortality. There's no accident in that. So it stands in this context for the savour and strength of the Christ character that has been revealed to us in the Beatitudes, in those eight characteristics that set forth the character of the citizen of Zion. Brother Sargent says this about salt. "When human pride brings rivalry among the disciples, he can tell them to have salt in themselves and have peace with one another. The salt of humility gives the savour of peace. But this potent quality of life does not belong to men by nature. How is it to be attained? Only by the self-discipline, which is self-sacrifice." That's all I've got the time to say about salt. We could extend that, of course, for another 15 or 20 minutes, but we don't have that sort of time. But I think you've got the point of what the Lord is saying. This kind of character is the character that will preserve men to immortality. It has an influence upon other people as well. It can preserve from corruption within families. If you've got this kind of character, it has an effect upon other people as salt has an effect upon that which, of course, it is applied to, in the case of the preserving of meat, for example. Then he goes on to speak about the light of the world in verse 14. "Ye are the light of the world," the cosmos. "A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid." Now, commentators think that the city he is referring to is Safed, which wasn't that far away from the place where he gave the discourse. I prefer to think, brethren and sisters and young people, that he's actually thinking about Jerusalem. For it was here that he went as a 12-year-old and spent, of course, several days there in the absence of his parents, Joseph, his adopted father, and his mother Mary. And of course, during his ministry, he often, when he was here at Jerusalem, would live out on the Mount of Olives. And he would look back at this city, particularly when it was bustling with people at feast times, when there would be lights throughout all the city. There was no way that you could hide that city of Jerusalem at feast time. And so he's talking about that city, I believe, when he says, "Ye are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hid." What does he have in mind? Well, he says, "Ye are the light of the world." And then says, verse 15, "Neither do men light a candle, but put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in the house." Now, this word candlestick is the word luknir. It means a lampstand. It happens to occur 12 times in the New Testament, and 12 is the number of Israel. So there's, again, you can see the harmony in that. But of course, the lampstand we know is a symbol for the ecclesia, the Israel of God. And so Zechariah chapter 4 comes into view. And we have the seven-branch lampstand with the two olive trees feeding it, the imagery of the age to come when Jew and Gentile will feed, as it were, the oil of the word into that lamp, and it will be the light of the world. Well, the ecclesia today, brethren and sisters and young people, needs to be the light of the world. It needs to be a city, as it were, set on a hill, and so do we as individuals need to set forth the light of the divine character. Now, light, of course, can come in two ways. It can come in teaching, the teaching of truth, and it can come in the manifestation of character. And the Apostle Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 6, when he speaks of the way in which Christ set forth the character of his Father, that we have this light, he says, knowledge in earthenware vessels, but we have the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. His character set forth the light of his Father. And so it's the character of verses 1 to 12 that he has in mind here. But you know, there are two ways that you can conceal that light. He mentions one of them here in verse 15. "Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel." Bushel. Now, a bushel, of course, was a measure of capacity used for buying and selling in the marketplace. It had to do with daily living, and it stands for the interference of business and the cares of life. And of course, we know only too well, do we not, that one of the things that gets in the way of the manifestation of the truth in our lives is this matter of daily life. Anxious care, working for Pharaoh, brethren, which I did for 43 years. It can get in the way of the manifestation of the truth in our lives. So light, the character that has been portrayed in verses 3 to 12, can be affected by a bushel. But the Lord in Luke chapter 8 verse 16 also mentions another impediment. He says, "Men don't light a lamp to put it under a bed." Now, a bed is a place of repose. And of course, it stands here for the antithesis, the opposite of the bushel. It represents inactivity, slothfulness, laziness. People who are inert, they simply don't do anything to manifest that character or to teach the things that belong to light. So we can have two problems. They're at the opposite ends of the spectrum, being too much involved in the commercial aspects of life, or, of course, simply doing nothing. So that is an exhortation for each one of us. He goes on to say in verse 16, "Let your light so shine before men in the manifestation of this character that they may see your good works." That's telling you it's got to do with character. "Your good works, and glorify your Father which is in heaven." Now, the section that we've got in front of us in verses 17 and 18 is about what he came to fulfill. He says, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill." Now, what does he mean here? Well, the word destroy means to dissolve or to destroy or to demolish. And the word fulfill, of course, means to make full, to fill up, or to complete. So these are antithetical. One means to demolish, the other one means to make it complete. So he says, I've not come to destroy the law of Moses or the things you read in the prophets, but rather to fill them up, to complete them. For verily I say unto you, and here comes the first phrase that he's going to use over and over again. First time, I say unto you, he is going to take the law and its principles to a higher level. He's not going to destroy it. He's going to fill it up and advance beyond it. That's what he's going to do. So he goes on to say, till heaven and earth pass, in verse 18, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Now a jot, the word is iota in the Greek, was the smallest Hebrew letter. A tittle was the little horn that they put on their letters, very small projections that differentiated between Hebrew letters in the alphabet. He says, not one jot or tittle is going to fail in the law. He goes on to say in that 18th verse, when he says, till all be fulfilled, whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. So he said that in no wise will one jot or tittle pass. And he says, if you treat these things with contempt, these matters, these principles of the law, you will in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. So we see that there's a joining together of what he says in verses 17 and 18 with that which he then follows in verses 19 and 20. And these two verses are about people who have written down the law. He says, whosoever shall break one of these least commandments. The word means to loosen, to unbind, to release men from bonds, to say, well, it doesn't really matter. What he's saying here is that even jot and tittle principles must not be diminished because they are principles of God. He will be the least in the kingdom. In other words, he's suggesting that there are everlasting penalties that apply to the diminution of God's law in either practice or teaching. He says, except your righteousness exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will in no case. Now, these two Greek words, ou and me, and there are two words in the Greek for the negative. Ou, of course, is an objective negative, and me is a subjective negative. They're usually used separately. When they are put together, it means absolutely no, absolutely not, or by no means. They're very, very intense. And we know that the Lord didn't actually use Greek words when he spoke the discourse, but the Spirit chooses those two Greek words, yokes them together to make it very clear that the diminution of divine principles, even the jot and tittle ones, will have everlasting consequences. There will be penalties that apply. And we don't know exactly what penalties they will be. They may be a diminution of status in the kingdom if the matter is not considered to be worthy of death, but they may be death, second death, and therefore non-entrance into the kingdom of God. And the Lord will be the one who will decide those issues in that day. So what we have here is something that we need to ponder for a while. You know, we tend to talk about the law of Moses having been put aside, which it has been. But brethren and sisters and young people, let us never make the mistake that some are making today in saying that we are not under law. We are not under the law of Moses, but we are under the law of Christ. And the requirements of the law of Christ absorb all of the divine principles and commandments that were inherent in the law of Moses and actually take them to a higher level. That's what he does here. So never, ever make the mistake that is foolishly being made by some, saying that we are not under law. We will find out at the judgment seat that that is not true, because the Lord says in John chapter 12, verses 47 and 48, the word that I have spoken unto you, it shall judge you in the last day. And what we have here in Matthew 5, 6 and 7 is just part of that word. And he will bring this out at the judgment seat, and we will be compared to it and asked why we didn't conform to it. It's as simple as that. So never make that mistake. And a proper understanding of Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 to 20 will allow you not to make that mistake. He says, not one jot or tittle of the law will fail, because it was holy, just and good. It enshrined divine principles. Oh yes, the rituals were meant to point to Christ, and the law as a package was set aside as a result of his death and resurrection. Oh yes, that's true. But nothing that was inherited in that law in terms of principles has been set aside. That, brethren and sisters, is what he's teaching here in Matthew chapter 5. And he says, unless your righteousness exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees, you won't be in the kingdom. So we have, of course, the kind of righteousness that we need to develop that they did not. So what was their problem? Well, the law of Moses enshrined divine morality and principles. Those principles, of course, have forever been there as part of the divine character and attitude. They were expressed in the law of Moses, which Paul says was holy, just, and good. How did these scribes and Pharisees and others approach it? Well, you see, they actually approached it from the outside. They focused on externals. Their life was about keeping rules. They, of course, conjured up all sorts of things, what they thought God was saying in the law. Sabbath laws, for instance, were quite incredible. You couldn't even crack an egg that was working on the Sabbath. And certainly they criticized the Lord Jesus Christ for taking a handful of grain in the field on the Sabbath. So they'd come up with their own interpretation of the law, focusing upon externals. Touch not, taste not, handle not, don't do this, don't do that, etc. Now that, of course, was taking it from the wrong direction. They were coming from the outside on focusing on externals. Brother Sargent says this, the Pharisee beginning from the outside fails to reach the core. Jesus, beginning with the innermost principle, works outwards to externals. So he worked from the heart. And that's where the law of God should be written. As Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 3, it should be upon the fleshly tables of our heart. Not the tables of stone that were external to the Israelites. Tables of the heart. Those divine principles written on the tables of the heart will express themselves in works, in deeds. That is what the Lord was talking about here. And that's what he means by a righteousness that exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees. He's not talking about their kind of righteousness where they focused on externals and rules. He's talking about what grows in the heart from the divine impressions that are made by his word. And that affects the way we think and act, and therefore it comes from within and works out to externals. That, brethren and sisters, is a different kind of righteousness. Now he's going to demonstrate what he means by this by contrasting the behaviour of scribes and Pharisees and the people of his day with what he expects in his disciples. So we come to verse 21, this matter of murder in the heart. He says, ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill, quoting from, of course, the law, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you. So he's going to step it up. It's going to be higher than the appreciation of scribes and Pharisees and rabbis and others. He's going to take them up to another level. I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. Angry here means to be provoked to anger, to be wrathful. Okay, we understand that, don't we? He says, if you are angry with your brother without a cause, and some think that those words are not there, but I don't see any reason why they should be dropped out, because he's actually talking here about the kind of anger that he experienced from his own people. They hated him. You ask them, why do you hate him? They probably couldn't have explained it, but they hated him. They sought to destroy him. He experienced that kind of anger. He says, you know what? That's actually murder. If you have a hatred and there's no genuine scriptural reason for you to have that hatred, it's only the law of the land, in their case the law of God, that will stop you from taking a knife and stabbing him to death. If there wasn't that law there, you would have stabbed him to death. So hatred in the heart without a reason is the seed of murder. And that is raising this whole matter to a higher level. He's digging into people's thinking, to what's in their heart. He goes on to say this. The second example is this in verse 22. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. Now, Raca is the Aramaic term of contempt, means an empty head, a senseless, empty-headed man. So this is a way of showing your contempt for someone. Now, we would use probably different terms today, but we understand where he's coming from, don't we? He says, you'll be in danger of the council. Now, that word is Sanhedrin. It's from whence we get Sanhedrin, the great council of 71 members, consisting of scribes, elders, and prominent members of the community and of the high priest's family. That formed the Sanhedrin, before which, of course, Christ himself was to come later on. So, brethren and sisters, he's saying there's a degree here. Angry without a cause, danger of judgment. Calling someone names that show your utter contempt for them, danger of being brought before the tribunal, the highest court in Israel. But he goes on to say in verse 22, but whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Now this word fool in the Greek is moros. It means dull or stupid. We get our English word moron from that. It has to do, of course, with someone who is heedless and perhaps morally a blockhead, as the word means in the Greek. This again, of course, is a term of utter contempt. He says you'll be in danger of hellfire or Gehenna. That was the Valley of Hinnom on the southwestern wall of Jerusalem, where they threw the garbage of the city over the wall, including dead animals and sometimes human beings who couldn't afford a funeral. And they rotted away there, and the fire never went out. It was always consuming the rubbish of the city. Of course, it's used symbolically of rejection at the judgment seat of Christ. So this is a pretty serious matter. Now, I guess there's not too many people in the room who haven't at times thought, if not said, contemptible things about others. Human nature tends to do that. But I think I can be fairly certain and say that there's not too many people in this room who haven't had things said about them that are contemptible. Manifestations of hatred or contempt in some way. And the Lord is now going to lay down a principle here, brethren and sisters, that human nature doesn't like very much. It's going to be the opposite to the way that we naturally react. What happens when someone says something very nasty about you? How do you feel about that? Well, I'll tell you how my nature feels about that. One, I usually want to get revenge in some way, say something nasty back or whatever. That's my natural tendency. And the other thing that I do is that I will probably never look at them or speak to them again. If I'm operating naturally, that's how our nature acts, isn't it? We know that from our own experience in the past. He says, I want you to do the exact opposite to your natural reaction. Have a look at verse 23. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, So you come to make a sacrifice. You turn up to the memorial meeting to make a sacrifice, as it were. And there rememberest, the word mimnesco means to call to one's mind, that thy brother hath aught against thee. You remember that someone has said something contemptible about you or done something which means that he or she is in trouble. They are in jeopardy. The Lord said that. If you have anger without a cause, you use terms of contempt and hatred, you've got a problem. You're in danger of the judgment, rejection at the judgment seat of Christ. They won't be in the kingdom unless they change their way. Who's going to change them? You. You, the victim of their contemptible words. Because they might not see that they have a problem. So you, the one that's been hurt, when you come to make a sacrifice, as it were, to God, and you remember, oh, I haven't sorted that matter out, leave your gift, he says. Don't bother with worship at this stage. Leave it and go to that person and sort that matter out and try and redeem them. Do you do that? I'll tell you something. I've not seen too much of it in my experience of 40-something years in the truth. Because it's not natural to human nature to do that, is it? And you see what he's doing here, brethren and sisters and young people? He's raising the principles of the law of Moses, because they were there, inherent clearly in the law of Moses. He's raising them to another level. I say unto you, this is the law of Christ. It's more demanding than the law of Moses. Except your righteousness exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you'll have no place in the kingdom. Now that's a challenge, isn't it? That is a real challenge. And you will not get that characteristic in a day. That's going to take you a lifetime to manifest. But if you're not heading in that direction, you'll never get there. And we're given opportunity to practice, aren't we? Because there'll be people that you've heard of that said nasty things or whatever about you or treated you with contempt. There'll be people like that in your experience somewhere along the way. Certainly in the world. How you treat that matter is up to you and the circumstances you find yourself in. But Christ is here talking about people in Israel. So primarily it's about what happens in the ecclesia. But the same principles will apply to others. Those people are in trouble and they need to be redeemed. And you are the one, the victim. The offended party is the one who will take the initiative to redeem them. That's hard. Leave there thy gift before the altar and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother and then come and offer thy gift. Gift, a present. God doesn't want it until you sort that matter out. Now that is raising the law of God to a very, very high level. And this is about peacemaking at the end of the day, isn't it? Blessed are the peacemakers. And Brother Sargent has this to say. He says the peacemaker is not one who plasters over a crack so that it does not show, nor one who takes the easy line of surface amiability. Peace is made by the love which builds up. It's about trying to save people, not plastering over or whitewashing, about saving people. The repairer of the breach, from Isaiah 58 verse 12. What better synonym for a peacemaker? And it's peacemaking he has in mind when he comes to verse 25. Because in verse 25 he's turning now from the victim of contempt or hatred or revenge, a desire for revenge, whatever it might have been that motivated the other party. He's turning now from you being the victim to being the culprit. You've made some mistake, and that's why you're being dragged off to a court of law. Verse 25, agree with thine adversary quickly. Now, this word adversary has to do with an opponent in a lawsuit. And the word agree means to be well disposed, of a peaceable spirit. So this principle of peacemaking is still in mind. Agree with thine adversary quickly. Without any delay, he means. Early submission is advisable when in error. And it's clear from the context that the individual involved here has a case to answer. It might be very minor in his view. It may be unjust in his view, but he has a case to answer. And the Lord is saying, early submission is the best course when you are in error. Don't try and justify yourself. Don't enter into your own defense to justify. Just acknowledge the mistake and acknowledge that you're not always right. That will create peace. He says the consequences may be that man's justice system, which is not always very forgiving, will lock you up until you've paid the uttermost farthing. I know what it's like, brethren and sisters, to be in that position when you have in fact made a mistake, but you don't want to admit it, or you don't think that the time is right to lay it in the open, and human nature will cover up. The Lord is saying, acknowledge it and get on with life. It's the only way forward. He goes on then to talk about the thought and the act. Now, I've gone over very quickly that section on murder in the heart and on the need to admit error, because I want to come to this section. I want to spend most of this session, or what's left of this session, on this matter of the thought and the act. So we come to verse 27. Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. So this is being quoted, obviously, from the law. Exodus 20, verse 17, Deuteronomy 5, 21, was one of the Ten Commandments. It just happened to be the seventh commandment. And seven is the number of covenant. So covenant issues are going to be involved here. Now we need to understand where the Lord's coming from. He was in a nation that universally accepted that a man had a right to put away his wife. And the only difference between the two schools of thought, the school of the liberal, Hillel, and the school of the more, you wouldn't call him a conservative, but he was certainly more conservative than Hillel, the school of Shammai, the only difference between them was the reason that you could put away your wife. Hillel taught you could put away your wife for every cause. And if you saw a prettier woman that you wanted to marry, you just had to wait and bide your opportunity, and one day she would spoil a meal, she would burn something on the stove or whatever, and you could say, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you, and kick her out and take the new woman. That was Hillel's teaching. That's why they asked Christ in Matthew 19, Lord, is it right for a man to put away his wife for every cause, whatever it might be? But the other man, Shammai, taught that you could only put her away for sexual impropriety. So if there was some sexual problem, she'd failed you in some way sexually, then you had a justification to put her away. Nobody, literally nobody in Christ's day believed that you couldn't put your wife away. Nobody. That was his problem. That's their understanding of the Old Testament, the law of Moses. He's going to demonstrate, as he did previously, that the principles of the law had been misunderstood. He's going to take it to a higher level. That, brethren and sisters, is why he raises this matter of adultery. Thou shalt not commit adultery. So he says in verse 28, but I say unto you, that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. He's going to raise it to a much higher level about what's going on in men's minds. That, brethren and sisters, starts to dig into you and me, as we shall see. But in verse 29, and I just want to bring these two verses into view, in verse 29 he goes on to speak about, if thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out, cast it from thee. Better to go into life eternal, maimed, or at least initially maimed, than to be cast into hell. Verse 30, he says, and if thy right hand offend thee, cut it off, and cast it from thee, etc. Now, why does he mention only the eye and the hand? You'll remember that in another place he talks about the eye, the foot, and the hand. Remember that? Why only here do we have the right eye and the right hand? Well, I'll tell you why. He has in mind verse 28 when he's speaking the words of verse 29. If thy right eye offend thee or cause you to stumble, as that word means, then pluck it out. And in verse 28 he said, whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her. In verse 30, when he talks about the right hand, that's the hand that men normally, unless they're Benjamites, pick up a pen with so that they can write and sign their name on a marriage document. I did that. I sat down in the Enfield Hall after we'd been married by a brother, and my wife and I got a pen and we wrote on a document. I did it with my right hand and so did she. And I committed myself to a lifetime with my wife. And you see, he goes on to say in verse 31, it hath been said, and this is the teaching that you've heard from your rabbis, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. So what we've got in verse 29 and 30 in the right eye, and the eye, of course, is a symbol for intelligence. What comes in the eye is interpreted by the brain. If your right eye offend you, whoso looketh upon a woman to lust after her has committed adultery. And in verse 30, in the right hand, this is about writing a bill of divorcement, which of course the Pharisees practiced. And that we will refer to again in a moment. So this is telling us something. But this is the question I want to address now. Brethren, and this is particularly applicable to brethren, though of course it is not absent from sisters, but women don't seem to have quite, except perhaps for modern women, but women don't seem to have quite the problem in this matter that brethren do, of looking on a woman. At what point does looking become sin? Now this is thinking cap time. I want you to think carefully about what we're saying here. What is thought adultery that he's talking about in verse 28? Well, you had a president in this country called Jimmy Carter, elected in 1976. And he, in one of his early news conferences, was asked by a reporter, and reporters, of course, tend to ask questions that will be sensational and produce some news for the newspaper tomorrow. This particular reporter asked Jimmy Carter, who was a Christian and proud of it, have you ever committed adultery? His answer was yes. Not a great way to start your presidency. But of course, he didn't mean that he'd been unfaithful to his wife. He didn't mean that he'd gone and physically had a sexual relationship with another woman. He was a Christian. He read his Bible. He was talking about Matthew chapter 5, verse 28. He said yes, because he believed that if you looked upon a woman to lust after her, and he'd done that, that was committing adultery. Now, was he right or was he wrong? What do you think about that? Was he right or wrong? Well, I think he was probably wrong. You know why? Because of this word, epithumio. Have a look at it here in verse 28. But I say unto you that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her. This is very important to understand this word. It only occurs 16 times in the New Testament. Thumio is the word we get our English word thermos from, and we put something in a thermos to keep it hot, so it has to do with lust, okay, heat, lust. And when you put epi as a prefix to a word, you intensify it. Epithumio means to fix the desire upon, to have the affections directed towards an object. Brethren, this is not about the unbidden thoughts that you may have when you're walking down the street and you see a very beautiful woman. I notice beautiful women. I do. And there wouldn't be too many brethren in this hall who would say they don't notice beautiful girls. It's just the way we are made because of the sin of Adam. That's the way we are. But when you see a beautiful girl, there's some choices to make, haven't you? You can either go like this. Here she comes, walking along the footpath. Oh, she is a stunner. And you watch her go past, and you follow her, maybe, to see if she goes into a coffee shop so you can sit there and have a cup of coffee and keep staring at her. And people do that. We have people, not Christadelphians, Ocker Australians, who sit and they do this. They put chairs outside the hotel so that men can sit there and watch the girls pass by. You know, and they get a sore neck. And their eyes pop out of their heads. There's a fixation, you see. And in their mind, there's a process going on, and the process is, oh, she's beautiful, and then, of course, it ends up, basically, they're actually mentally committing adultery with that woman. There's a fixation on that woman. Brethren and young men, if when you're walking down the street and you see a pretty girl and you straight away reckon, because you've got a conscience, you straight away recognise that there's a problem that may be beginning here. She's a pretty girl. Leave it at that. Let your eyes look in another direction, straight forward. Let her pass. Stop thinking about her. At that point, that is not heart adultery. There has to be a process that leads to this fixed. Who's he talking about? He's talking about Pharisees. And the Pharisees, many of them, because they were following the teachings either of Hillel or Shammai, particularly Hillel, because they could put away their wives for every cause, they would walk down the street and say, wow, now she's a better looking woman than the one I've got now. I'm going to make sure that I watch my wife very carefully so that when she does something for which I can justifiably, under Hillel's teaching, put her away, I can say, I divorce you, and then I can go and get her. That's what he's talking about, and that's what they used to do. And we need to be careful. We've got to be very careful that we don't underdo what Christ is saying here. That's dangerous. He said that, didn't he? That if you diminish the law of God in any way, there are eternal consequences for that. You must not diminish it. But you've also got to be very careful, brethren, not to overdo it. You know what? I knew a young man who could have been a Christadelphian who had a problem, who shot himself in a telephone booth because of that verse. He knew he could never reach it. His understanding of that verse, it was shallow, it was wrong, he shot himself. So we've got to be careful we don't overstep the bounds on either side of this matter. He's talking here about fixed desire. And this is how it works. Here is the natural man. We've sliced this man's brain in half. This is the way we are naturally when we're born and we mature and we start to think and reason. We have propensities in our flesh. Paul calls it the law of sin, which is in my members. And when the truth's not active and doesn't develop the moral capacity that God has given to us, then the propensities work in harmony with the CPU of our brain. The CPU is the area where you have intellect, thought processes, like the engine room of a computer. This is the 1 and 1 equals 2 area of our brain. And the flesh says, for instance, I'm hungry. A message is sent by whatever means to the brain. I'm hungry. You mean you can actually feel it, can't you? I'm hungry. It's telling the brain, feed me. And they work in harmony. Now you can react to that in 1 of 2 ways. You can either say, well, I'm hungry, I therefore will get out my wallet because I need to buy the food. Or you can walk up to someone's refrigerator and say, I don't know who this is, but I'll just pinch something out of here to satisfy my hunger. Now that's how people work today. That's why we have shoplifters. Because there's no morality. This is not developed in them. Propensities work in harmony with intellect. It's carnal. It leaves God out of the picture, which is what the serpent reasoning did in Genesis chapter 3. It just pushes him aside. He's not there. This is the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, working with the mind. So Paul says in Ephesians 2 verse 3, we were fulfilling the desires of the flesh, that's propensities, and of the mind, because they work together. There was nothing that stood between them. That's the natural man. We're all born like that. But this is the way we should be. This is the law of the heart that he's talking about. Now, Brother Carter makes a very interesting comment. He says, the heart is the deeper part of the mind where character is formed. In other words, the morality that God has given to every man is developed. This is something acquired from outside. And what this does is it puts a wall, as it were, a barrier, so that the morality, which is from God, it's not from us, the morality that's from God will have an impact upon the process of propensities working with intellect. I want you to come to Romans chapter 2. This is where we read of this matter. Romans chapter 2. In verse 12, for as many as have sinned without law, and I'm going to miss out some definite articles here, and you can listen carefully. Where I miss it out, it's because they're not in the actual Greek text. For as many as have sinned without law shall also perish without law, and as many as have sinned in law shall be judged by law. Now there's a bracket that comes at the beginning of verse 13. So I'm going to just jump over to the end of that bracket at the end of verse 15 and read verse 16. In the day when God shall judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ according to my gospel. So saying, you live without law, then, well, you'll perish without law. If you sin under law, he doesn't mean the law of Moses here, if you sin under law, then you'll be judged by law. What law will judge you and me? Well, the law of Christ. Okay? But what about this section in brackets? Very important. Verse 13. For not the hearers of law, I'm not talking about the law of Moses, not the hearers of law are just before God, but the doers of law shall be justified. For when the Gentiles, who have come into the truth, he means, which have not law, not like the Jews had a law, Gentiles didn't have a law, do by nature, the word is fusi, it means by an infused disposition. This is something that's come from outside of them. They do by an infused disposition or way of thinking the things contained in the law. He does mean the law of Moses here because it encapsulated the principles of God. These having not law in their origins as Gentiles are a law unto themselves. He doesn't mean by that that they create their own law. The law is that which is written on their hearts. Read verse 15. Which show the work of the law which Jews were under, written in their hearts, their conscience, and the word is sunidasis, it means a knowing with oneself. This is this word down here. And knowing with oneself or one's own witness, this is an infused disposition that's come from God, from his word. It becomes a witness. What's it witnessing against? Well, it's witnessing against the natural processes of the flesh working with the intellect, the brain. He says this, they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts, that's this process, their intellect, their thoughts, the meanwhile accusing or else excusing one another. Now that's how conscience works, brethren and sisters, and particularly young people. If you haven't got a conscience, you're not going to be in the kingdom of God. Full stop, or as you say here, period. End of story. If you do not have a conscience, then you will not be in the kingdom of God. Because this is how the law of the heart works. It works by God instilling into you a morality which you do not have at birth. You have the capacity, but it has to be developed and acquired from without. And when that happens, it becomes a witness. So that when your flesh says, I want to do this, and it can be any one of the things that might come under the heading of the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life, whatever that might be, when your flesh says, I want to do that, then your brain will be affected by this morality, this witness. And what that will do is that it will allow your intellect to make a decision. Yes, that is approved, excused. I can do that under the law of Christ, the law of God. Or no, that is not approved. It is condemned by the law of God and of Christ, and therefore I must not do it. That's how conscience works. What he means by the law of the heart. Now that, brethren and sisters, is how we must operate every day of our lives. And that's how the Lord Jesus Christ operated. I want you to come back to Matthew chapter 5 because I want to talk about Christ and temptation. Now this is another tricky subject, which has caused a lot of heartache in our community in recent times. And it's, of course, been a problem for a long time. There are some people who think, and I want to just go back, I just want to go back and do that again. I want you to watch the screen. There are some people who think that if this was Christ's head, then what happened was that when temptation came to bear upon him, it sort of bounced off his cranium. Never got into the intellect, into the processing area of his brain. You know, the area that is 1 and 1 equals 2. They think somehow that sort of bounced off. Well, if that's the case, we've got a problem. And the verse that they use principally is Proverbs 24 verse 9. The thought of foolishness is sin. Well, of course, it doesn't quite mean that. This word thought is zima, means plan, device, purpose. The RSV says the devising of folly is sin. This is about fixing a desire, planning how you're going to accomplish it. This is not about a thought coming in and sort of flying off. This is about processing till you get to the point of saying, this is my plan. Now that is quite different, isn't it? Brethren and sisters, Christ had the greatest conscience of all time. Never did a man have a conscience like him. And when thoughts were suggested to him, and they did come from outside, that's why there's a tempter. In his temptation in the wilderness, there's a tempter there outside of him making suggestions. They had to be processed in his brain. But he had the greatest morality of any man who ever walked the earth. And every single time that a wrong suggestion came to him, it was repelled by it. It is written. It was pushed out. And that's how we should be. We can't help unbidden thoughts, brethren. It just happens. But we can use our divinely instilled conscience to say, that's the end of that, push it away and look somewhere else. We can do that. But the Pharisees were looking for opportunities to get rid of their present wife because they'd found someone prettier. Their eye was offending and their hand was about to break a covenant. That is what he's talking about. Just one quote about Christ and temptation from Brother Sargent. For whatever view may be taken of some questions surrounding the temptation, one thing is fundamental. He was tempted. He knew temptation as a fact and conquered it in the power of the word. And this was part of the experience by which he was made perfect in order that others may be made perfect through him. As he tasted of death for every man, so also he tasted of temptation. And as through death he obtained an eternal redemption for himself, that it might be for others, so through temptation he gained a victory for himself, that others might share its fruits. It's a terrific quotation. He goes on to say, abstention alone, however, is deficient. Not a matter of just cutting off, it's about putting something in its place. It is right to abstain, to cut off the hand or pluck out the eye rather than indulge in those things which may be a snare to others. But there are always some who seem to think that righteousness consists in finding fresh things which must not be done. They don't put the good in the place of the evil. Romans 12:21, be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. Now, there's differences, and I've been given the 5 minutes warning, so I've got to be quick. There's differences between the teaching of Christ and the rabbis, clear differences between, of course, what is said in verse 27 and verse 31. They said in verse 27, by them of old time it was said, he quotes the law. In verse 31, it's not the law. It's the rabbinical interpretation of the law. In verse 31, it hath been said, not by them of old time, not by Moses, but by your rabbis. Whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. That is what the rabbis taught. It wasn't Christ's teaching. And Deuteronomy 24, which they quoted, of course, doesn't actually say what they said that it was saying. Brethren and sisters, very quickly, I want to just address this issue. It's a touchy issue as well, but I wouldn't be fair to God or Christ, the deliverer of this manifesto, if I didn't say something about it. I wouldn't be doing my job. In the so-called acceptive clause of verse 32, where is there a permission to remarry? It's not here, nor in Matthew chapter 19. Where is the permission to remarry? What is this passage actually saying? Well, you see, if this is an acceptive clause, then it's a parenthesis. I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, that's the parenthesis. Let's drop that out and read it again. Whosoever puts away his wife causeth her to commit adultery. That's the bottom line. The only way you can avoid that is if she's already committed it. Whosoever shall marry her that is divorced committeth adultery. That's pretty simple, isn't it? You do that with parenthesis, don't you? You can just drop it out, like we did in Romans chapter 2. In those times, banishing a wife virtually condemned her to remarriage just for mere survival. She would have to remarry to survive. So these Pharisees, who were putting away their wife for every cause, were actually pushing them into adultery while they were committing adultery themselves. And the other individuals who came into those marriages were also committing adultery. It was multiplying adultery. The only escape from culpability for creating multiple adultery is if the wife has already committed it. And nowhere does Christ give permission for remarriage. In the record of Mark 10, verses 2 to 12, Luke 16, 18, they're quite unequivocal. There are no exceptions in those passages because the so-called acceptive clause is not an exception to a rule that allows you to remarry. It was never designed in that way. Hence the disciples' view. When in Matthew 19, Christ spoke the words that we know so well, their immediate reaction was this: if the case of the man be so with his wife, it is not good to marry. They understood him to mean that if you did put away your wife, then you remained, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7, unmarried. Didn't go looking for another one. It is good for a man not to marry, was their conclusion. Next time around, we'll have a look at the law of love.